back to the levels of cinema going we were seeing pre-pandemic and maybe exceed this.
Phil Clapp, Chief Executive of the UK Cinema Association, thank you so much. Yeah, that Barbenheimer moment last summer, do you know what came after that? It was Paw Patrol and Saw, so it was Saw Patrol. Which I don't think, it didn't have the same oomph.
It works, didn't it?
It works, somehow.
The voice of the UK. And the home of the Premier League. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock. It's Saturday morning and it's Five Live Breakfast, the start of the weekend on Five Live with Felicity Hannah and Chris Warburton. And the headlines this morning, fears are growing of an all-out war in the Middle East. The UN political affairs chief, Rosemary DiCarlo, is warning the region is at a risk of a conflict that could dwarf the devastation witnessed in the region so far. He was speaking at a meeting of the Security Council discussing the deadly synchronized detonation of pagers and walkie-talkies used by Hezbollah. Francis Guy was a UK ambassador in Lebanon between 2006 and 2011.
The signs would be that they haven't wanted to escalate it. And if you think that behind them is Iran, who's calculating them as part of this, they also have not wanted to escalate it. It's in their interest to keep a pressure on. It's not in their interest to end up in all-out conflict. So they don't want it. But if you are endlessly being attacked, then there may come some point where you respond, unfortunately.
Hezbollah has confirmed that its senior military commander, Ibrahim Akil, was among those killed in Friday's Israeli airstrike on a building in the southern suburbs of Beirut.
A former manager of Fulham's women's football team, Gote Haugunes, says precautions were put in place to protect female players from Mohamed Al-Fayed when he owned the club. Mr. Al-Fayed, who died last year, has been accused of sexual assault by dozens of women who worked for Harrods. The department store says it's utterly appalled by the allegations.
Labour delegates a gathering in Liverpool for the party's conference, which starts tomorrow. Ahead of it, Downing Street says Sir Keir Starmer and his most senior ministers will no longer accept donations to pay for their clothes. Follows criticism after it emerged he had received more than £16,000 for work clothing and glasses. Our political correspondent Helen Catt says ministers are hoping the conference will now be able to focus on policies.
This will be a celebratory conference to some degree. It's the first conference in government for a decade and a half. That will be within that recognition that there are, as they keep saying, difficult decisions to be made. We know there are tensions within the party about some of those decisions, like the winter fuel allowance, about things like the party's stance on Gaza. And it'll be interesting to see how many of those surface over the coming days.
A death row inmate has been executed by lethal injection in the US state of South Carolina just days after a key witness claimed he was innocent. Freddie Owens had been convicted of killing a shop worker in 1997, but on Wednesday, his co-defendant told the state's Supreme Court that Owens was not present when the crime took place.
And 700 paratroopers will jump from planes over the Netherlands today to mark the 80th anniversary of one of the most daring operations of the Second World War. Operation Market Garden saw thousands of soldiers leap into Nazi-occupied territory near Arnhem in what would ultimately be a failed mission. Now, James Gray's got the sport. It was really interesting speaking to George Grove, just to speak to someone who had absolutely experienced that hothouse environment of stepping out into Wembley.
Oh, amazing.
And he was saying, you know, it's different to these guys because they can actually ask people who have been there before. But George said this was the first time they had tried a fight on that scale, this country before. And there was 80,000, I think, at Wembley, which would have been capacity then, I guess, because Wembley's got greater capacity, hasn't
it? They've worked out, haven't they, how to get more people in for that structure.
Yeah. And he was just saying, but I couldn't ask anyone. And then you're suddenly walking out there and, as he said, his words were, you know, it's not Joshua's first rodeo. He's been there. He's done it. He's experienced it against Klitschko, hasn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
At Wembley, for example. And you do wonder, I don't know, you know, Dubois seems a pretty mentally strong and focused guy, doesn't
he? They back themselves, don't they?
Yeah, of course they do. And that's what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah.
But to walk out there and just go, oh, okay, this is all for me.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know if it would, because, you know, boxing's such a mental game anyway, isn't it? And
it
to get focused and be in that place and remember everything about the person who's about to start clouting you is quite demanding.
And you've got to remember that a lot of these boxers, you know, they have an amateur career, most of them, and that's fought in front of, you know, three men and a dog. And actually, a lot of the other people in the arena are other fighters and their trainers who aren't really paying attention to what's going on.
Yeah.
And then they might be on undercards.
Yeah.
Even if they're on undercards at places like the Manchester Arena or whatever, that is still, you know, there's still small amounts of people in there. So,
because half the people haven't turned up.
Exactly, because they're not there yet, and there's people milling around getting drinks and hobnobbing interviews. So actually, when you get in, I mean, that is going to be, you know, ridiculous, really. You're right that AJ has obviously experienced, you know, 70,000, 80,000 before. What's the difference between that and, you know, not a lot to him? You're right. So maybe there is a bit of a mental edge there.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know. Look, it's such an odd sport, boxing, when you think about it, isn't it, in that regard, you know. Mm-hmm. Is it going to affect you? Is it going to spur you on? Is it going to, you know, make you just lose?
I suppose once you start fighting, you're probably not really thinking about it, because you've got other stuff going on, haven't you? You know what I mean?
Yeah, you've got a big 6'6" bloke standing near the corner ready to give you a whack.
That's it, right? You know, just on crowds, by the way, because we've been asking for the biggest attendance you have ever experienced, that you've been a part of. We've had some great ones, actually. I kind of thought, well, it's going to be sport and music, but there's been across the board. Here's a music one. One of our listeners saying, biggest crowd, Roger Waters at The Wall live in Berlin, 1990. What a combination of factors. 250,000 tickets sold. Anything from 100,000 to 250,000 gate crashes, he says. One of the happiest days of my life.
Oh, we've got Andrew in Bristol says, aged 18, I was one of 150,000 at Bath Festival of Progressive Music. I like this. I like the big crowds for stuff that I've never really listened to. It's just the best music festival lineup ever.
And we're doing the smaller ones as well, aren't we, actually? Smaller crowds. We can do large, small, nothing in between. Gary is in Kettering. Smallest crowd, Labby Siffrey. I love Labby Siffrey. At Corby Festival Hall. Started with 12 people. After 20 minutes, one couple left. And at the end, he asked what songs we wanted him to play. That's quite nice, isn't
it?
Your own personal jukebox. We all had a drink with him in the bar after. Got signed merchandise. I think it was in the early 2000s.
That's
can't be bad. You wonder with Labby Siffrey, because he's been sampled to death by various hip-hop tunes. So I wonder now, you know, maybe a different generation. Who knows? Anyway, 85058, big crowd, small crowds. Here's James.
There we go. A new era for the Women's Super League champions. Chelsea started with a 1-0 win over Aston Villa. What was the curtain raiser of the new season? It was a winning start in the league for new manager Sonia Bompastor as they look for a sixth title in a row. Hull City got their first win of the season as well last night in the Championship. They won 3-1 at Stoke, whilst Motherwell beat Dundee United 2-1 to reach the semi-finals of the Scottish League Cup. It's the final weekend of the regular season in Super League. Hull KR will finish second to Wigan, earning a home semi-final in the playoffs. They beat Leeds Rhinos 26-16 last night. It means that Leeds miss out on the eliminators. Warrington end the season third. They beat Broncos. Lee got past St Helens 18 points to 12, and both of those two sides make it through to the knockout stages. The new rugby union premiership season kicked off with a repeat of last season's final. This time, though, Bath avenged that defeat. They beat Northampton 38-16, and 96,000 people will be at Wembley tonight. You can join them as well here on 5 Live with full fight commentary and build-up. Love boxing on the radio. For the all-British heavyweight clash between Anthony Joshua and Daniel Dubois. 8:30 tonight, that is.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
Saturday breakfast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
8:08. Good morning. If you're just joining us, it's the start of the weekend on 5 Live. We have got a big name hour of radio coming up in all sorts of different ways. So we've got Eddie Hearn on The Big Fight. We've already heard from George Grove. So Eddie Hearn will join us live. We'll have Jeremy Bowen is going to be joining us live, our Middle East editor, to tell us about the ongoing situation, which we're going to get into in just a moment, with Hezbollah, Lebanon, and the situation with Israel, of course. We also have Chris Sutton, massive names, Chris Sutton, who'll be looking ahead to Liverpool against Bournemouth. And the name I'm not allowed to say yet will be the winners, one of whom is very famous, of the celebrity race across the world. If you're watching it, we're going to give you the opportunity for a spoiler alert, all right? Because, you know, you might only be on episode one, because that's how these things go. But the winners will be joining us live in the studio, which is quite exciting.
That's how I watch Traitors, you know. I was really, really behind with Traitors, and then I just keep seeing people coming into work to do interviews. And I was like, oh, right, okay, well.
Oh, they're out.
Well, now I know.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
It's
a difficult place to avoid what's going on. going on sometimes.
Hard to hide away, it is.
That's true.
Yeah, before all that, like, we're starting today with the Middle East, where fears are growing of an all-out war between Israel and the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. Now, yesterday, Israel killed a senior Hezbollah commander in an airstrike in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. The group confirmed that Ibrahim Iqil was among at least 14 people killed. Earlier this week, more than 30 people were killed and thousands were injured when pagers and walkie-talkies belonging to Hezbollah members exploded.
Well, Israel hasn't commented on the attacks, but it's clearly believed the intention was to weaken the Iranian-backed group, which has been firing rockets from Lebanon since Hamas attacked southern Israel last October, displacing tens of thousands of people from their homes. Francis Guy was UK ambassador to Lebanon between 2006 and 2011. Earlier in the programme, she told us that Hezbollah hadn't wanted an all-out war with Israel, but that could change.
As they've been quite cautious in some ways so far, the signs would be that they haven't wanted to escalate it. If you think that behind them is Iran, who's calculating as part of this, they also have not wanted to escalate it because it's not in their interest. It's in their interest to keep a pressure on. It's not in their interest to end up in all-out conflict. So they don't want it. But if you are endlessly being attacked, then there may come some point where you respond, unfortunately.
Well, Lina Khatib is an associate fellow at the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House, which is an international affairs think tank. Lina, morning.
Good morning.
I think for a lot of our listeners, you know, we've been getting our heads in the last 12 months around an awful lot to do with the political and the military affairs between Israel and Gaza. And now, you know, Lebanon kind of hotting up in the mix. Can you just explain to us what the situation is between Israel and Lebanon and how even Iran feeds into this?
Well, Hezbollah emerged in Lebanon in the early 80s at a time when Israel had occupied Lebanon. And since then, Hezbollah has presented itself as part of Lebanon's defense mechanism vis-a-vis Israel, even though Israel eventually withdrew from Lebanon in 2000. Iran has always backed Hezbollah. So the creation of Hezbollah in the 80s was done through Iranian funding and support. And this Iranian funding and support has not stopped. And that's because Hezbollah is part of Iran's strategy to have influence in the Middle East. And so what is happening in Lebanon today is because Hamas is another entity backed by Iran in the region, so it's an ally of Hezbollah, because Hamas is also obviously fighting Israel, Hezbollah has felt that to maintain a sense of credibility for itself as part of this so-called self-styled resistance kind of group vis-a-vis Israel, it had to enter the fight actually quite symbolically in the beginning against Israel. And so Hezbollah started launching rockets on Israel last October and has been doing so for almost 11 months now. And Israel, of course, was not going to put up with it for very long. So, you know, it started bombing Lebanon in return, and this tit-for-tat continued. But I think, you know, things are shifting right now. Israel is increasing the pressure on Hezbollah. I still think neither Israel nor Hezbollah wants all-out war and doesn't actually need to.
Doesn't actually need to, but you've talked about the tit for tat and things kind of escalating because, you know, no one can leave the other player having the last word. Are you concerned that it might tip over into all-out war?
I mean, the possibility is always there, but the likelihood of all-out war remains, in my view, a bit low, just because on Hezbollah's part, because of the series of attacks it has endured this week, unprecedented attacks through pagers exploding, walkie-talkies exploding. This is the kind of hybrid warfare that Hezbollah was simply not prepared for. It has caused disarray within Hezbollah. It is now not able to really deploy its military capacity because any such large operation requires using communication tools, and these have now been shown to be deeply compromised by Israel. So Hezbollah, even though it still has a huge military arsenal, is not really able to use it against Israel. And even if it tries, this would actually be suicide because Israel will be very decisive in its response. On Israel's side, it is achieving quite a few goals with these hybrid attacks. So I don't think it needs, for example, to invade Lebanon to achieve its goals. It's already humiliated Hezbollah and weakened it to quite a paralyzing degree.
Yeah, a really sort of just unimaginable before this week attacks through those walkie-talkies, through those pages. We've talked a lot about, you know, Lebanon sort of being supported by Iran. Israel, of course, has its own allies. The key ally is the US. Do we know what America thinks of the latest actions by Israel?
Lebanon is not supported by Iran. Iran only supports Hezbollah in Lebanon, which basically does its own thing without any authorization from the Lebanese state, which is, of course, a huge problem for Lebanon because Hezbollah has been dragging Lebanon into instability without basically the Lebanese people at large agreeing to that or the Lebanese state wanting that. When it comes to the U.S., the U.S. is clear that it doesn't want to see all-out war in the Middle East. But the actions of Israel this week have all been targeted strikes against Hezbollah. So this is an escalation on part of Israel, but that is not necessarily the path towards all-out war. So for the U.S., as long as all-out war doesn't break out, whatever Israel does to kind of defend itself, to attack Hezbollah through targeted strikes, despite collateral damage, is something that the U.S. Still support. So Israel is definitely not going to see a shift in the US position after this week.
Lena, thank you very much indeed. That's Lena Khatib, who is Associate Fellow at the think tank Chatham House. And before 9 o'clock, we'll be talking to the BBC International Editor, Jeremy Bowen. Always brings a lot of clarity to these situations.
I think I called him Middle East Editor, didn't I? But he's more than that.
He's multiple things.
He is.
He knows a lot of stuff. Jeremy Bowen.
There we are. That'll do it. 16 minutes past eight.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of sport. It's Anthony Joshua versus Daniel Dubois for the IBF World Heavyweight title.
Anthony Joshua with a stunning statement here.
Let's go. What have we got to lose?
Two hard-hitting British heavyweights go head-to-head at Wembley Stadium.
Here, full ringside commentary.
Tonight from 10 p.m.
on 5 Live and BBC Sounds.
Yes, indeed. We've got the big fight for you live later on tonight. We're going to speak to Eddie Hearn later. We've been talking about massive crowds, the biggest attendance you've ever been in, because it is going to make post-war British boxing history with a record crowd of 96,000. Although, to be honest, I was looking at, you know, before the war.
Have you found the answer?
Well, I couldn't see anything bigger than 96,000 in this country. Hmm. So I think, I don't know why we're saying post-war, because I'm not sure there was anything pre-war that was bigger. Dunno. But anyway, yes, your stories of the biggest attendances that you've been part of. Let's bring in Chris Sutton. Hey, Chris, morning.
Hi, Chris.
Morning. What's the biggest crowd you remember playing in front of?
Oh, blimey. probably something like maybe 70,000, 80,000, I think.
Which
I played in front of 60,000 every week.
Well,
at
exactly.
Celtic.
I was going to say Celtic, yeah. What was the 70, 80,000? What would that have been?
That would have been the UEFA Cup final 2003, where we lost against Porto. They dived a lot, the Porto players did. Mourinho.
Oh, right. Say no more. But what, because we were talking earlier about, you know, Daniel Dubois, he's got to come out, you know, Joshua's experienced a crowd like that before at Wembley. Sorry, we will get on to other things, Chris. But like we were talking about, you know, having to try and get rid of that noise or use that noise or whatever. And I don't know, how aware of it when you're going out there, or are you just so focused on what you're doing you can just shut it all out? Well, what's it like?
I think, yeah, look, I mean, I'm no boxing expert, and of course as a boxer, they're on their own as football. You're part of a team, but I think I was always aware of the atmosphere pre-match, but then once you kick off, then you try and focus on the job in hand and the importance, and just you know, playing your role or playing my role as part of a team. But no, as a boxer, Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of an awkward one, isn't it? You're out there on your own. If
you're 96,000 people, you know, it must be absolute madness, mustn't it? And also, you know, they have all the fireworks displays and all the rest of it. It's full on craziness. Anyway, look, let's talk to you about the Premier League. Liverpool's home game against Bournemouth this afternoon. So Liverpool hopeless against Forest, weren't they? But then brilliant against AC Milan. I thought, let's hear from Arne Slot, the Liverpool manager, expecting a tough test from Bournemouth.
They were aggressive last season. I saw this because I saw parts of the game yesterday. They were really aggressive, high press, made it really difficult for Liverpool to get the ball forward to the forwards as well. Scored a goal by a high press. I think they took the ball off, I think it was Trent, and scored. And that's the style they usually play, so that's also what we expect from them tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, so contrasting in just a matter of days, wasn't it, Chris? Because I watched the game against AC Milan and they were disciplined, they were controlled, and they were so different to how they had been against Forest.
Yeah, I've got to say, I mean, I was there last weekend against Nottingham Forest. I didn't see that performance coming from Liverpool, especially in the final third. They were, you know, off with that final ball. Mo Salah was quiet. Diaz was quiet off the other side. I mean, you credit Nottingham Forest for the way that they played and the way that they defended. But I think it was a careless display by Liverpool. And then, of course, going to Milan and responding in the manner which they did do. That was a huge positive. But I suppose today it's one of those games where if Liverpool do want to be considered as titled contenders, then they can't afford to slip up again. I know it's very early on in the season, and they will be expecting to beat a Bournemouth team. But do you know what? Under Andoni Iriola, they're a Bournemouth team who probably will feel they deserve more points this season. They had that win at Everton, so they've already won on Merseyside already this season, but they should have beaten Newcastle and were very unlucky against Chelsea.
Yeah, they can be tricky, can't they? So that'll be interesting. Spurs, there'll be another. I mean, what would you be thinking if you're a Spurs fan at this point of the season? I mean, it's so early on. But they're just, I've just read your piece on the BBC Sport website and you got it bang on about it. It's just not happening in the final third for them, is it?
No, I mean, I cannot believe the pile on and some of the nonsense which has been talked about Ange Postecoglou and his Tottenham team. Last season, I think that, you know, he goes into the job. I think they were eighth the previous season. They sold the star guy, Harry Kane, to Bayern Munich. And they progressed last season, got up to fifth, you know, an attacking brand of football, which Spurs fans had demanded because of the previous couple of managers, Conte and Mourinho, where it was very negative football. So there was a great improvement last season. We're only just into this season. They've been, as you say, in the final third. They've just lacked that spark, that cutting edge with that final ball. And they signed Solanke, who's had an injury issue or two, and he hasn't quite got going yet. But the performances have been there in the main, and they just haven't been able to score goals. And then there's this enormous pile on and question marks over, is it the right brand of football? So I do not get this, the criticism of Postecoglou and Spurs. But what do we know? They play Brentford today, and the pylon will continue if they don't get a result.
Well, and that's before we even start talking about Everton, which we did do earlier on. That's what we've done. Well, my goodness me.
That's the World Cup final for them today, isn't it?
Isn't it? Leicester. Wasn't Robbie picking you up on describing it as the World Cup final at 6:06 last week?
He was, but Robbie's issue is he doesn't understand context.
Yeah, I've never noticed that. Although, yeah, okay. All right, Chris, we'll look forward to hearing you later. Thank you. Sutton, summariser for Five Live, Liverpool versus Bournemouth. It's the first of four commentaries this weekend in total. We're going to bring you Crystal Palace versus Manchester United from 5:30. And tomorrow we've got live commentary of Brighton versus Nottingham Forest from 2:00. And then at 4:30 tomorrow, biggest game of the season so far, Manchester City versus Arsenal, which we'll bring live to you as well. Can I just say, by the way, before we introduce our next guest, because we need to give a spoiler alert.
A big spoiler alert.
And things will become clear. The scent in this studio.
I'm so glad you said
has
it.
Markedly improved. And that's not saying anything about you, Fliss.
I don't smell bad.
These fellas, my goodness me.
These people.
They can't speak yet.
Yes.
Which, when we reveal who it was, we'll show it's, that's no mean feat.
But yeah, they are here. They do smell great. Their dog is outside. This is your moment. Okay, if you have not caught up on the final episode of Celebrity Race Across the World, you probably want to turn this off. I'd say until 5:30, but we're always late to the news, aren't we? So you know, give it a little bit after 5:30. We are about to speak to the winners in the studio live right now.
Now, the latest series of the BBC One show, which is a fantastic watch. It came to an end this week, and I'm going to tell you who won it. All right, here it is. It's Scott Mills.
Oh, wow. You can talk, so pleased.
Scott. And his husband, then fiancé Sam as well, is here as well. Hey, Sam.
Morning.
Becoming the first to reach the final checkpoint, crown the winning team, and they just pipped Ted Lasso star. This is Kula Bikini and his cousin Mary. Here's a clip.
3, 2, 1. Yeah! Oh my God, we did it.
Speechless. When you open that book and there's no other names in it, there's no other feeling like it.
I'm just glad we flipped the coin. To have a great experience and win is just the best.
Yeah.
Wow. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I can speak now.
Yeah, you can.
I think that was enough time with the spoiler alert.
It was all right, wasn't it? But yeah. You won't believe how much grief we get from people.
Because I was doing Radio 2 breakfast show this week, and it was that thing, it was on Wednesday night, Thursday morning. Do you talk about it?
Well.
Because a lot of people, over 60% watch on catch up on iPlayer.
Is it as many as that, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So okay. I kind of talked about it, but didn't say that we won.
Which is annoying, because you want to shout about it.
Yeah, well, of course.
You've had that in for 6 months, and then you've kept it so quiet, and then it's like, oh, can't talk about it now, because we might spoil it for people.
We did it in March.
Was it as long ago as that?
Yeah,
right. Well, that is a long time. Yeah. was anyone trying to get it out of you?
All the time.
Yeah. Okay.
So there was Radio 2 in the Park, big event recently, and every single person does this. Did you win? Oh, actually, don't tell me.
Because they want to know and they don't want to know, and it's both equally. It's really hard.
It's been hard. And also, before we went, you can tell selective people, but they really do want to keep a lid on it. So, but we didn't have our phones, so no one could text us anyway.
Yeah, the whole phone thing. Mm. We were talking about that earlier, weren't we?
It's like 5 weeks with no phone.
So, but you don't even, you have no idea where you're going. And as soon as you get to the airport, they say, right, phones please. And then they're like, you're off to Brazil.
Brazil.
Wow.
So where did you have to go from and to? What was the deal?
So the whole complex was from the Amazon to the Andes. So it was the top of Brazil to basically the bottom of Chile. So we went through Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, Chile.
Yeah. Wow.
In 30 days.
And I suppose that kind of terrain, you're going from places which will be really sparsely populated in some areas, and then bang, into some of the biggest cities in the world.
That's right. So you've got, I mean, so much of we were in Brazil the most time because it is huge.
Massive.
Lots of it, as you said, very much kind of like rainforesty, then quite deserty, and then it's like, bow, you know, huge, like Sao Paulo, which is, I think, the fifth biggest city in the world. So we saw so many contrasts, and actually each country was different, very different.
And you had a bit of a shaky start, didn't you? I mean,
we just didn't know what we were doing. Sorry.
You were hit with delays, you had it all.
I think, with this, you just can't predict anything, because in South America, they haven't got trains.
No.
So their main mode of transport was buses, and they were probably every 5 hours because they go massive distances. If you think, our average bus was about 20 hours long, and we still didn't get that far. So if you miss a bus, then you've got to wait 6-7 hours for the next one. There's no other alternative.
It's quite mad to think that we have travelled 12,500 kilometres on a bus.
That is.
And we found out quite quickly that there were no trains, and obviously we're not allowed to fly. That's one of the rules.
Yeah, of course, a bus. Yeah, that's it. That's the only thing.
We had one ferry,
okay,
which did cost us a lot of money.
But it helped us a lot.
And I remember, I went to Brazil years ago, and I remember getting a bus from Rio down to more like the coast, further down south. And that was a long, and it was, you look on the map and you think, well, that's not that far.
Yeah, that's exactly
and then
what happens.
You're on it forever.
Forever.
And mm-hmm. it's very windy yeah. and it's very full on.
Yeah.
Now, that show, right, how is there so often a foot race at the end of an episode? I mean, are they all 100% genuine? You're in the same place and it's that close.
It's all down to us, the route we take, what buses we take, if we decide to take a taxi at the end. So on episode 5, the three of us couples are all running in the same distance. And we didn't even know Jeff and Freddie were behind us until we looked behind. But that, we chose yeah. to get a taxi there. We could have waited to get a bus, which delayed us 2.5 hours. So it was our choice.
That has never happened before on the show, where we were all literally running together at the same time. That's never happened.
Yeah.
And it was just a massive fluke. But obviously the producers loved it.
Yeah, of course.
But then sometimes, like on the final, it looks, because you want the suspense of they, you know, who is it? Is it going to be them or them? But in reality, they were how many?
About three hours behind us.
But that looks boring on television.
Yeah.
But you know, it's all transparent because you can see it written in the book. But on the telly, you want that drama of like, who's it going to be?
Who's going to open the book first?
And what I love about this is you had no idea that you were first. You thought you weren't.
In fact, they didn't leave it in the show. But when we were at the bottom of that really large volcano, we were like, there was two choices. Do we get the chairlift, which, by the way, was very slow and looked like it hadn't been used for about 30 years, or do we try and run up and walk up? The altitude was ridiculous, so it was hard to catch your breath. We decided to run up. Well, I started to run, and then I slowed down, and I remember saying to Sam, there's no point running. We're last. So you have no idea.
No idea at all.
Absolutely. And also, because no phone and no... They make sure you absolutely don't know where the others are. It makes you a bit paranoid.
Yeah.
And you think... The negative in you always thinks you're last.
Yes. Or third. And miles behind.
Third or fourth.
You'd rock up like 2 days afterwards and just be like, hi, we made it.
There was one time that we did come 27 hours behind. We opened the book and we were 27 hours behind.
But that
shows you're always going, have you made the right choice? Have you made the right route? Because we knew that there's some times during the race that we were so far behind.
I also think there is a bit of luck involved, because what if your bus breaks down? There are so many variables that could happen. Or, oh, we've just missed the bus.
But the thing, and I try not to say this in front of my kids because I think they'd sort of burst the bubble a little bit, because you want the idea of just the two of you going through all of this.
Someone's got to film it.
Yeah, is it just one other person, or is there a kind of producer type person?
Obviously, you've got a little crew with you. But they don't say anything to you at all.
They don't speak to you. I mean, they'll have a chat, they interview you.
But in terms of the race, like if we were at a bus stop and that was our stop,
yeah,
they wouldn't go, guys, easing off here. Yeah. They would let us sit on it, and then the bus goes off, and then we're like, we've missed the bus stop.
Right,
and then we'd have to work out. So they don't get involved.
But there
at
must
all.
Be bits, because I remember, you know, there's bits where a car, you're travelling in a car, and then there's a shot of the car driving by. So you must have to be in that person's car and say to the camera, right, we're going to get out now, and then you hang out, and we'll just get a shot of the car driving.
And you're like, this is time.
With you will have what's called a fixer, which is somebody that speaks Portuguese or Spanish. And they will explain to this poor driver who's just been flagged down on the street by us, are you okay to be filmed? Have you got insurance? Let's go,
yeah.
But I remember sometimes with the crew that were with us, you would say things, you would test them, like, I wonder which is the best way to get to Mendoza? And they would just go...
Poker face.
Yeah. Shrug.
Yeah.
And what I love, like, you might not have had your phones with you, but you had one incredibly important bit of kit, which was like a proper old-fashioned alarm clock.
Yeah, I'm quite proud of that. Because,
it's good thinking.
Because I was like, well, how are we going to wake up? If we've got a bus at 5 a.m., the crew are not going to wake you up.
Yes, very good.
So I bought, next day delivery, the oldest school alarm clock.
With the bells.
On the top.
By the end of it, there was nothing left of it.
It was in those backpacks for 5 weeks.
So. You think we were chucking them bags on buses?
Yeah, right.
The bells had fallen off by the end, but it did still make a kind of vibrating noise, enough to wake us up.
Love it. Excellent. Right. Well, you can tell people now, can't you? You
know, we won!
That's it. You've won the damn thing.
And I wasn't expecting that at all. But I don't think the viewers were.
Do you know what? This has all been incredibly positive, and I want to ruin that now. Like, What's Sam's most annoying travel habit, do you think, under pressure?
Oh, good question.
I'll come to you. Don't worry.
He lives his life wanting to know everything, even like a year ahead. He loves a spreadsheet. He wants to be like, what are we doing in 4 weeks on Tuesday? And on this, that is taken away from him completely. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. But I actually think it has made him more chilled out about things like that.
Feels like we've gone into a therapy session.
it's like couples therapy.
Come on, Sam, just talk. Talk it through.
No, to be fair, I like to just plan everything, but with this, you can't plan. So I just kind of let go and just live for the moment.
Yeah.
Very good.
Brilliant.
And him, or is it a long list?
No, for him, it was just, he was always a negative Nancy and kind of...
Not always.
Not always, but if we missed a bus, he's like, well, that's it, we may as well go home now. We've lost the whole race. One coming in 3 hours. He's like, we're done now.
There were times where I was like, well, that's it then. There's no point carrying on. And also, after a while, not having a phone is amazing.
Really?
It's amazing. And it doesn't take long. One or two days and you're done with it.
Yeah.
And then when they said, do you want your phone back, when it all ended, we actually said, can you keep it for another night?
Another night, yeah.
After 5 weeks.
I get it. I totally get it. Listen, thank you.
Thank you so
Thanks
much.
Very much. Really good to see you
nice
both.
Nice to see you.
Yeah, nice to see you too. I was thinking of who previously someone had left a mark in terms of their beautiful scent, and it was Tommy Fury.
Well, I'll take that.
You can take
believe that.
All right, yeah,
it could be Sam.
I want to get a photo with you. We're going to read the headlines, aren't we?
Shall I read the headlines?
Maybe not during that.
No, probably not.
We'll do it after.
But it's Scott Mills and Sam as well, and you can catch up on Series 2, the whole thing. Not much point now, because you know he's won. But Celebrity Race Across the World, it's on the iPlayer. It's still good entertainment. Yeah. It's 8:35, time for the headlines.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
So let's get your headlines at 8:36. I'll do it because Chris is off being starstruck, I think, over in the corner. Hezbollah says two of its senior commanders were killed in an Israeli airstrike on Beirut yesterday. It's a major escalation of the conflict in the Middle East, adding to fears of an all-out war in the region. It's emerged that Fulham put precautions in place to protect women players from being sexually assaulted by the club's former owner, Mohamed Al-Fayed, when he was in charge. The billionaire who died last year has been accused of sexual assault by dozens of women who worked for Harrods when he was the owner. Angela Rayner is promising to complete devolution in the north of England. The Deputy Prime Minister will tell the Labour Party conference that starts tomorrow that the government will transfer extra powers to local areas. I'm back for the last bit.
Oh, am I?
Chris?
Am I?
No, I'll finish it off. You intro, James. A prisoner has been executed in South Carolina just days after a key witness said he was innocent. Freddie Owens had been convicted of killing a shop worker during an armed robbery in 1997. But on Wednesday, his co-defendant, Stephen Golden, told the state's Supreme Court that Owens was not present when the crime took place.
And James is here with the sport. What are we... Well, it's the boxing, I suppose, isn't it?
The boxing, the Premier League, the rugby union, the women's super... It's like a vintage, gritty sporting Saturday on Five Live, isn't it? We'll start with the Premier League. We're actually going to do it in reverse order because why not? Manchester United manager Erik ten Hag says that Marcus Rashford is returning to his very best form. I think that much is clear. He scored 3 in his last 2 matches. He's really taken control of his career, hasn't he? He's hit a personal best 30 goals in his first season under Ten Hag, and then it collapsed, didn't it, last season, his form, Marcus Rashford. He scored just 8 matches, just 8 goals, I beg your pardon. He lost his place in that England squad as well for the Euros, didn't he? He was also dropped for their FA Cup fourth round tie at Newport in January as a disciplinary measure after going out without permission on a trip to Belfast. However, this season, he's completely turned things around, and it was the end of December before he reached the same tally that he's already on last season. Here is Ten Hag.
That probably he needed some help by backing him, for instance. But at the end of the day, he has to do it by himself. And he has to set his life right. He has to set his training attitude right. He has to set his match attitude right. And when he sets all his professionalism, he will perform because he's a class player.
So that kicks off at 5:30, Manchester United, away at Crystal Palace. That's a 5:30 kickoff, of course. Our 3 o'clock commentary base is Anfield, where Arne Slot's Liverpool will look to avoid losing back-to-back league matches since March of 2021. Bournemouth are the opposition this afternoon, and Schlott has great admiration for Androne Iraola, his opposite number in the Cherries dugout.
I think Iraola has done a tremendous job over there, plays nice football to watch, develops players, has a nice playing style, so all credits for him, but hopefully we can manage to do better against Bournemouth than we did against Nottingham Forest last week.
Of course, the day's top flight football gets going with West Ham Chelsea from 12:30 and two Women's Super League fixtures as well to keep your ears across in Five Live Sport from midday. Now, Anthony Joshua says he is still in the battlefield and has quashed any suggestion of nearing the end of his career as the Briton weighed in heaviest for tonight's world title challenge against Daniel Dubois, the two-time unified heavyweight champion. Joshua takes on Dubois for the IBF belt at Wembley Stadium tonight. Here's another heavyweight of heavyweights, Lennox Lewis.
You could call it a resurgent. I mean, right now he's very focused. He looks like he's thinking differently. He looks like he's on that search and destroy kind of mission thing. You know, I've been seeing him focus in his last couple of fights, so he's ready.
Five Live has commentary later on, meaning that you can join the 96,000 at Wembley through the wireless later. The build-up gets going from around 8:30 this evening. In the new Rugby Union Premiership season today, Exeter host Leicester. Saracens and their new captain, Mario Itoje, travel to Gloucester. The action, however, did get underway last night with a repeat of last year's final. Bath taking on champions Northampton, and they got some revenge as well, did Bath, for losing that final with a 38-16 win in front of their home fans at the Wreck. Bristol beat Newcastle 24-3 in the night's other curtain raiser. And Southport's Matthew Baldwin is leading the way at the BMW PGA Championship Golf. A second round of 66, including 7 birdies, saw him end Friday 13 under par at the top of the leaderboard, 2 shots in front of the chasing pack. Rory McIlroy, meanwhile, is a few shots further back on 9 under.
Could have been a little better, but I think also it could have been a little worse as well. So 4 behind going into the weekend. You know, not too many people between me and the lead. You know, it's a good position to be in. So a couple of things I want to still try to work on over the next couple of days. But, you know, I'm happy to be where I'm at and feel like give myself another good chance to win this tournament.
And third practice gets underway for the Singapore Grand Prix, by the way. In just under 2 hours from now, you can listen to that on the BBC Sports website.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Yes, you're listening to Weekend Breakfast with Chris Warburton and Fliss Hannah. And now we've got Simon King with the weather.
Good morning. Just like yesterday, we're going to see some pretty intense downpours and thunderstorms developing across southern England, through the Midlands into Wales, perhaps one or two coming into the east of England as well into the afternoon. Now, like yesterday, these showers will be hit and miss, so not everybody's going to see them. But in the worst of the showers, there'll be a lot of rainfall falling in a short space of time. That could lead to some flash flooding. There'll also be some frequent lightning, some hail and some gusty winds all to go with that as well. We've already got some showers moving into central southern parts of England, but they'll become a bit more widespread as we go through the afternoon. Away from those showers, there'll be some sunny spells developing, but further north across England, Scotland, Northern Ireland, we've got some cloud affecting parts of northeast England, eastern Scotland, central Scotland in particular. A lot of that cloud may just stick around along the North Sea coasts this afternoon, perhaps the central belt as well, but elsewhere there'll be a few sunny spells developing. And maximum temperatures today getting up to about 18 to 21 degrees in northern parts and about 18 to 23 Celsius further south. Simon King, 5 Live Weather.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Saturday Breakfast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Good morning. 96,000 people for the big fight tonight. Anthony Joshua, Daniel Dubois, post-war British boxing record crowd, that'll be. Biggest crowds you've ever been a part of. Celtic versus Leeds, says Mac in London. Hampden Park, April 1970. European Cup semi-final, 136,000 people there. Still the record for a UEFA Cup tie, he says. Chris in Puglia, I saw Queen and Nebworth. 120,000. Same problem with the car park that we heard about earlier. We can't get enough of that. So didn't actually leave until 6 a.m. because of all of that. Unbelievable stuff. Let's bring... Paddy Keelty is with us. He's going to be with you from 9 o'clock. Morning, Patrick.
Chatting to you two guys is the biggest audience I've ever had.
Come on,
biggest audience I've ever had.
What's the biggest audience you've been involved in? Can you think of something?
I would, well, a couple of things. I was lucky enough to host the opening ceremony of Special Olympics when it came to Ireland, 2003. So that would have been 90,000 people in Croke Park.
Man.
I think it was going live to something like 800 million people. Nelson Mandela lit the flame. It was, I got to meet Muhammad Ali. That was a big day. That was a big, big day. But, and I also remember playing in one of those football games where Man United played Celtic. And it was, one of those charity games.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And so, you know, you've got half the team, which are proper players, and then half are kind of numpties, like me. And
can you play at all?
Well, I'm a very, very, very bad goalkeeper. But finding out that Celtic Park was sold out, and then sitting with Gordon Strachan, who was managing Man United, and I said, so am I on in the first half, Gordon, or am I on in the second half? He goes, no, you're on the whole game. And I said, so is it a celebrity keeper for Celtic as well? Who's doing goals for Celtic? He goes, oh no, Paddy Bonner. Paddy Bonner.
It's like an anxiety dream.
The terror.
I
broke into a cold sweat, and at which point Roy Keane, he was playing in the same game, was just sitting beside me, and he goes, like, you don't fancy it, Pat, just say. Like, I would have thought, like, a Man United fan like you know, if you don't fancy it.
He's an easy man to say no to, isn't he?
Yeah. So I'm getting the sweats even just thinking about that crowd. Henrik Larsson scored a hat trick. I was rubbish. We got stuffed.
Okay. Good summary. That's perfect. Hey, you got Les Denis on the show, haven't you?
Oh, we've got Les Dennis. I love Les Dennis. Les is on tour with Ghost, the musical. We're going to be talking to him. We're going to be talking to Andy Zaltzman. We're going to be talking all about Taskmaster, a little bit of Beat the Commentator with him. And we have the Jay-Z and Beyonce F. Cook in Jonty Road and Lisa Faulkner. Oh. There you go.
Fantastic stuff. All right, we'll see you at 9. Cheers.
All righty. Cheers, guys.
Patrick Keelty with you from 9 till 11 on 5 Live. It's 8:46.
Now, a conflict in the Middle East that could dwarf what we've seen so far. That was the warning from a senior United Nations official about the escalating conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. Israel killed a top Hezbollah commander and other senior figures in an airstrike on Beirut yesterday.
And Ibrahim Akil is his name, who was wanted by the US in connection with the 1983 bombing of the US embassy in Beirut, was among at least 14 dead and 60 injured. It follows the extraordinary explosion of booby-trapped pagers and walkie-talkies, which killed 37 people and injured thousands more. Hezbollah has fired 150 rockets into northern Israel in response.
There's a lot going on. It's moving very, very fast. But the BBC's international editor, Jeremy Bowen, joins us now from Jerusalem. Can unpack this for us. Jeremy, morning.
Morning.
I suppose, first of all, just remind us who Hezbollah are. And I think some people would say that they're a more dangerous enemy of Israel than Hamas.
I think Israel would say that. The Hezbollah emerged about 40-something years ago. They are a group which is much more than a militia. They're also a political movement. They've had people in the Lebanese cabinet. They're very close to the Iranian government. They follow the same area of Islam. They're Shia Muslims. And they are, if you like, they are a state within a state, which is actually more powerful than the Lebanese state itself.
And they've had the most incredible setbacks over the last week, first of all, with those booby-trapped walkie-talkies and pagers, now with the death of one of their most senior commanders. How significant is Ibrahim Akil's death?
Well, it's certainly significant for them, because he was one of their top men, and this extraordinary and audacious attack on pagers and radios, turning them into small bombs with such devastating effect on civilians as well, who were close to them when they blew up, as well as on the Hezbollah operatives who were carrying them. So it's been a catastrophic week of security failures for Hezbollah. But at the same time for Israel, while these are significant tactical victories, they've humiliated and damaged their enemy. What they haven't done is getting closer to their strategic objective, which is essentially to change the status quo so the border war ends, that Hezbollah stop rocketing northern Israel. Israel wants to repopulate border towns that have been evacuated during the last year. 60 to 70,000 Israelis not in their homes, actually double that pretty much on the other side of the border in Lebanon, because of the way that Israel has been hitting that part of Lebanon. And the reason why there's so much alarm about what's been going on, including, it has to be said, among Israel's most staunch Western allies, led by the United States, also the UK, is because Israel, in the last few days, has taken a decision to escalate that border war, because I think they have listened to what Hezbollah have been saying about not wanting a regional war and Iran. And while the Israelis say they don't want one either, I think they feel they now are able to push harder and to risk one in the hope of trying to change the dynamic and cause some real damage to their bitter enemies in this movement in Lebanon.
When Israel's so occupied in Gaza with the conflict there that's just shy of going on for a year, does it have the capacity to also allow things to escalate on the border with Lebanon?
Well, it has a very big and powerful air force, so it's got plenty of planes and pilots. There's a question mark about whether, if there was some kind of ground invasion of Lebanon, and I don't think it's imminent at the moment, though they have moved more troops up to the border, whether they can sustain a protracted campaign. And that's because the Israeli army is built on reserve units. People leave their jobs and go back to their reserve units and fight. And in the last year, some reservists have been away from their jobs and away from their families for months and months and months, and they're exhausted. So Israel as well is getting messages from particularly the US saying, don't do this, don't go in there. But there have been voices raised in Israel saying it might be possible to have a limited ground operation, causing a lot of damage to Hezbollah positions in southern Lebanon without provoking that wider dreaded regional war. But I think that is quite, if they actually went ahead and did that, and I've also had this from senior officials as well in among Israel's allies, then it's a real risk. It's quite an irresponsible risk, because once war starts, it's very hard to control. You do not know which way it's going to go.
And we've had some really serious words out of the UN warning of a potential catastrophe. How have Israel's allies responded to what we've seen this week? To, for example, those explosive devices detonating when people were in supermarkets, in cars?
Publicly calling for calm, privately really frustrated. Because they have been trying to de-escalate what's been going on. There's been an American envoy who's been going between Lebanon and Israel, and he's come up with a framework that might be possible to try to calm things down. However, Hezbollah particularly have made it absolutely clear that they're not going to agree to anything until there's a ceasefire in Gaza. So it comes back to that. One thing the last year has shown is that the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians is absolutely at the heart of a lot of the trouble, not all of it, but a lot of the trouble in the Middle East. And at the moment, trying to get to that ceasefire is something that is really important for those who want to calm things down, and actually at the moment not going to happen. You know, in the end, longer term, the only way to stop the turbulence in the Middle East is by a series of really far-reaching diplomatic and political deals. And the most fundamental, one of the most fundamental, is the continuing desire among Palestinians for independence, which Israel opposes. Also, that Iran is, you know, a formidable potential adversary of Israel, and they too have seen as a great threat in the region. But getting to that point is really a long way off. And while diplomats, politicians, they'd want to stop this escalation and they'd love to somehow get to a ceasefire, even that right now is not possible. So all the, you know, all the danger warning lights, if you like, are turning red. And that's something which is really quite alarming, and it's hard to control. And while they've been to the brink before in the course of the last 12 months,
yes,
they seem to be lingering very close to the edge right now.
Jeremy Bowen, our international editor in Jerusalem, thank you very much.
It is six minutes to nine. Anthony Joshua, Daniel Dubois, big fight tonight. It's going to be live on 5 Live, contesting the IBF heavyweight world title at Wembley Stadium. 96,000 fans they are expecting for the heavyweight fight. We can speak to Matchroom boxing chair AJ's promoter, the one and only Eddie Hearn. Good morning, Eddie.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Do you know, we were talking to George Groves earlier on, who has experience of Wembley, obviously with that big fight against Karl Froch 10 years ago now, Eddie. And he was saying, look, for him, there was no one there to tell him what it felt like, you know. I suppose for these guys, AJ's been there, hasn't he? You know, he's done it. He did it with Klitschko. He knows what that Wembley experience is like. For Dubois, you've got to wonder what it'll be like as he's doing the ring walk there, Eddie, because it must be absolute madness.
Yeah, I don't think anything can prepare you for it, really. I mean, it's AJ's fourth Wembley appearance, I think sixth stadium appearance in the UK, and it is like bread and butter to him. And, you know, it's a lot to take in for Daniel Dubois. He has boxed Alexander Usyk in Poland in a stadium. You know, he's boxed at Wembley before, but on an undercard, but this is extreme pressure, you know, the biggest of challenges. And for both men, just a real career-defining night.
I thought it was really interesting where Joshua said, hopefully he won't experience another defeat, Eddie, as he doesn't, in his word, like losing, which I thought was really interesting to hear because, you know, and you know more than anybody, you don't often hear boxers even contemplating the prospect of losing before a fight. And I wonder what that says about where AJ is at the moment, you know, slightly more contemplative and maybe a bit more humility in his thought process. What are we to read into that?
No, I just think he's kind of very real and very aware of the risks and the dangers of the heavyweight division. I mean, you know, we've had it in the balls of our hand before, you know, the defeat to Andy Ruiz, the comeback victory against Andy Ruiz, the two defeats to Usyk, the ups and downs, and he's on a great run, you know, four wins, three knockouts on the spin, and particularly in the last two fights, has looked sensational. But this is a very dangerous fight. You know, both guys have extreme power, size, speed. It's why it's such a thriller, you know. But I think for AJ, just aware of the dangers and the risks, he's never really been one to talk himself up or, you know, be arrogant or overconfident. So there is a big air, and there always has been a big air of humility to him. And you know, he's very confident going into this fight, but he's prepared, you know, and he's done it respectfully for this challenge, which is a big one tonight.
Did you always have Dubois pinned as a future champ?
Not really. I mean, he started out, you know, he was a Team GB fighter. These guys have sparred rounds before, you know, rumours that both guys have been hurt backwards and forwards, and you would do against these, you know, big punchers. But I think, you know, Dubois started out, he looked really dangerous. He was knocking everyone out. Then he suffered the defeat to Joe Joyce. Then there were question marks. Then he came back a little bit. Then he went to fight Usyk. You know, he dropped Usyk with that controversial low blow that many feel wasn't. And Usyk didn't get up, but Usyk went on to stop him. Then he's come back with wins over Jarrell Miller, and particularly against Filip Hrgović in the last fight. You know, I think he's really, you know, gained his credibility and his opportunity for this big fight. he's a young man that's kind of been through the fire at a very early stage in his career. And it looks like he's, you know, he's really full of confidence now.
Yeah.
Can he carry that confidence on such a stage?
Well, that's it. We will find out. The winner likely to be first in line to face the winner of Usyk's rematch with Fury in December, I guess, Eddie. You know, look, people want AJ Fury, don't they? You know, I mean, they're not getting any younger. This is the thing, isn't it? And when they get to a certain point, it won't have... We've had so many times in boxing, haven't we, where... finally two boxers get it together, but they're not at their peak. They're not the fighters they were. It'd be such a shame if we end up in that scenario with these two, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've got a real great chance here to have both guys fighting each other for the undisputed heavyweight world championship, which if that happened, all the waiting and frustration would be worth it, you know. But I think either way, that fight has to happen in 2025. Obviously, we've got to do our job tonight. Hopefully, Tyson Fury can dethrone Alexander Usyk December 21st in Saudi Arabia. And then you've got it there. And it will 100% happen. You know, Riyadh season will make that event happen. And even if one of them loses and one of them wins, I think it will still happen. Even if both of them lose, I think it should still happen. But obviously, the size of that fight really depends on the two upcoming results. So we just got to do our job tonight.
Okay, let's see how it goes. Eddie, thanks for giving us some of your time. Appreciate it. Busy old day for you. Good luck with it. Eddie Hearn, Matchroom Boxing Chair, AJ's promoter, of course. The fight is going to be live on 5 Live tonight from 8:30.
It will. And we will be back tomorrow from 7.
Don't come in an hour early.
No, okay. Not in an hour early.
Extra hour. Stay with us on 5 Live. Patrick Kilty up next.
The UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
It's 9 o'clock with the news for 5 Live. I'm Carl Hartley. Fulham Football Club say they're working to establish if anyone at the club has been affected by sexual abuse following allegations against their former owner, Mohamed Al-Fayed. Dozens of women say the billionaire sexually assaulted them while working at his department store, Harrods. A former manager of the women's team has told the BBC that Fulham put extra precautions in place to protect female players from Mr. Al-Fayed, who died last year. Sports Minister Lisa Nandy says she'll be speaking to sporting bodies.
These allegations are historic. My concern is twofold. Firstly, that the victims must have justice. And secondly, that we have to have processes in place to make sure that this can't happen again. These are conversations that I'll have with different sporting bodies.
Hezbollah has confirmed a senior military commander, Ibrahim Akil, was among those killed in an Israeli airstrike in Beirut. A senior UN official has warned the Middle East is at risk of a conflict that could dwarf the devastation in the region so far. Labour members are gathering in Liverpool for the party's conference. Sir Keir Starmer's been facing growing criticism after it emerged he received more than £16,000 worth of clothes and glasses. He's now announced he'll refuse any further donations. Tom Baldwin is a former director of communications for Labour and Sir Keir's biographer.
I think Keir Starmer's pretty frustrated. I think he's upset that his wife has been dragged into this controversy over the last week, something that he never really wanted. And, you know, she never really wanted to be part of this political world and just wanted to look nice for the election. And I think we have to be quite careful about keeping this in proportion.
Gavin Robinson will make his first leader's speech to the Democratic Unionist Party conference in Belfast this afternoon. He's expected to promise a new approach after the DUP was reduced from 8 MPs to 5 at the general election in July. And the owners of the zoo in Telford, which has spent all week searching for cinnamon at the capybara,